I'm going to call the meeting to order. We have a quorum, so Representative Mason, I'm sure you've read the minutes and would have moved the minutes. Thank you. All in favor of approving the minutes, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Hearing none, the minutes are approved for February 19th. No, wait. These are February
20th.
I can't even read the dates anymore. All right. Today we have a on the agenda today we have a presentation from the BioBusiness Alliance of Minnesota about their system. I'll let you introduce it, my good friend at the witness table, Dale Wallstrom. If you could please identify yourself for the Historical Society and start your presentation.
Thank you, Chairman Mahoney. My name is Dale Wallstrom. I'm the CEO of the BioBusiness Alliance in Minnesota. To the committee, we're really happy to be here today. We have a long agenda, actually, and we're going to go as quickly as we can through it. But the request that, our intention today is to present, try to help you understand what we're doing with the money that you gave to us last year, and give you a general update on status of where the industry is with a special focus on the systems dynamic model. We have a series of speakers that will be coming in to update certain aspects of our work. But I thought what I'd do to start with is just give you a general overview of the agenda. I think you have handouts in front of you. It might be easier to follow. These are a little hard to read. But fundamentally, what we want to do is cover the various topics that are are the highlights. It's not everything we're working on, but there's some of the highlights that we're focused on right at this moment. And I'd like, Mr. Chair, with your permission, since this is an update, is it acceptable to just ask for the committee members to feel free to ask questions when it comes to their mind? How would you like to handle that?
Mr. Wallstrom, we could do it either way. If you prefer to get through your whole presentation, or would you prefer that we stop you when we have a question?
I think it might work better if we go through each section and then answer the questions at the end of that section, if that's all right.
Well, then what I will do is at the end of, I will expect you at the end of every section to, you know, signify, okay. Are there any questions?
Okay, perfect. Thank you. Okay, this will be our agenda. I'll introduce people as they come along or as they come up. First slide is just to show you the status of our funding. You can read this, I think, for yourself, but we currently have raised approximately, our investment so far is about $2.2 million. State funds is about $1.57 million, and our raised funds in work in kind is about $1.1 million. That's from 2005 to 2007, 2008. Our projects, if we keep them all on schedule, will run about $2.2 million. As you can see by the graph, by the way, I should add, when you look at the graph, if you look at the colors, the red represents the money that's in the door. The pink is the blue. The pink represents the efforts we have to collect additional funds, of which we don't turn them to dark red until the check is in hand, or the letter of commitment is in hand. We are confident we have a significant amount more coming in, but we're not sure we'll hit the full $2.2 million that we need to complete our task for this year. So we will stage our work appropriately to accommodate that. So that's the status right now. I have any questions on that? Any committee members? Okay. Moving on, just to refresh your memory, we have there are three initiatives that we are strategic initiatives that we've been working on since our formation 3.5 years ago. The statewide assessment was our first initiative that was published, was online, and you've all seen that probably more than you care to see that over the last couple of years. We're now deep in the middle of Destination 2025. which is our 20-year strategic planning and roadmap activity, which you'll be hearing from Steve Dahl from Deloitte in a few minutes, who will update you on our collaboration with Deloitte Incorporated. And then the third piece is what we call a BioBusiness Resource Network, which is our efforts to provide a structure and support to the growth of actual companies and industry within the state. And we will hit a couple facets of that. There are many aspects, and I won't repeat this because I don't want to beat it to death, but there are many different projects that we're working on, and we only have time today, even with the extended agenda, to cover a portion of those. We're just picking the highlights. All right. This slide you've all seen before, but for the benefit of those in the audience, I'm going to take just a minute to cover it. This is the result of a work that's been done by a group of individuals from government, academia, and the private sector over the last year. It's actually about 13 months, represents 13 months worth of work to try to take the life science community and understand how to think about it and how to organize it. So the way we look at this, so in effect, what this picture is to us is a picture of everything we have going on in the state. And everything, every project that we work on, every activity we undertake ties back to this picture in some way or another. And the way to think about this is the following. The top line represents the private sector. This is the world of where companies are formed and created, and are, and jobs and most economic wealth is generated in that area. This is a world where those companies are, to be successful, they will go where they have to go to get the resources and the support they need to be successful. The bottom three boxes represent what we call community capability. Those bottom three boxes, starting with the very bottom box, which we call foundational capabilities, are those basic things like K-12 education, roads, bridges, internet systems, all the infrastructure and as many, including entertainment to attract young people to stay in the community, all those kinds of things that are necessary to create a community that works. And then policy. And policy is policies that are appropriately applied to incent and support everything above the three top boxes. So this is the world, in our minds, this is the world of the public sector. This is your world, to a large extent, in local government, local cities. The green line up above represents the world of the academic sector, things that we call enabling knowledge clusters. And these are the basic skill sets and knowledge, fundamentals of knowledge that are necessary to be able to support a given kind of industry. In this case, we're talking about life sciences. So as we go across, you'll notice we have things like catalysis, which is formation of catalysts to create cheaper and better forms of ethanol, or nanotechnology, which is a basic technology that is needed to support many industries, not just life sciences, but electronics, pretty much everything. It's a movement towards small. And as you go across, they're just basic skills and knowledge. This is, like I said, the world of the academics, and it represents workforce development, it represents research, fundamental research. But in order to compete in the life sciences, we have to have at least an operational capability in all these areas, or we can't function competitively globally. Commercialization catalyst is the larger box in the middle. And this is the world where this is a place where all three worlds come together. This is a place where investment is shared between private, public, and academia. It's a place where the skills and the capabilities to move a piece of knowledge from a laboratory into a formation of a company and job creation, this is where that happens. These are things like UEL for incubation falls into that, as well as, and for those of you who don't know, there are 36 incubators in the state, spread around the state. There's some in Bemidji, there's some in Wilmer, the Midwest. I'm sure you've all heard of Midwest. It's a great incubator location. But there are 36 of them across the state. You see the term acceleration in there. We don't have any accelerators yet, but we're working towards that. And I won't go into that level of detail right now. But this is an area that facilitates transfer. And there's many capabilities that are required. And this, like I said, is a convergent world between all three sectors of the state. We understand that in order for this to work, in order for this to be successful at the state level to help the state grow, we have to be looking at this on a statewide basis. So this next map represents a project which we call the Minnesota Life Science Community, which you will hear more from Pam Bishop. She will cover this in more detail. But this is a project that we're collaborating with as an initial phase with the Southern Minnesota Initiative Foundation, with the intention of taking this across the state as soon as we can. This is a process we're trying to go through to connect the entire state to the resources and the capabilities that are defined on the prior slide, the one with all the colors on it. This is a critical piece because there's no community in this state, not Rochester, not Minneapolis-St. Paul, not Bemidji, not Duluth. There's no community in this state that can do this alone. It requires that, because it's a highly, life sciences and the evolution of life sciences requires a highly integrated, knowledge-based community in order to function. So our goal here is to get the communities, or we'd like to see communities interacting and looking at their capabilities. And the process that we're engaging to do that is defined in the next slide. Historically, you've always heard us talk about Minneapolis and St. Paul, or the metro area as being a cluster zone for medtech, especially for medical devices. That's true. We are. We have other clusters. We have animal health in certain parts of the state. We have forest products in other parts. We have traditional clusters. The basic philosophy of the cluster concept is that every community, represented by the circle on the left, every community has their own manufacturing, their own research, their own services, etc., and they begin to build it out. We know that that's not possible, and we also know that cluster model is evolving. And what it's evolved into is what is the more current thinking is that it's in a concept called hubs and nodes. And where you have, and hubs are defined as communities or places where you have design, the ability to do complete design and deliver the product, and nodes are areas that have specialty skill sets. As an example, Hormel Institute in Boston is a great example of a nodal function for cancer research. They have unbelievable capability. The node can reach out across the globe and become a capability for the world, and they can sell their services to the world. So what we're in our efforts to try to bring focus on the capabilities of the state of Minnesota, which I might add, the longer I'm involved in this role, the more proud I am of the state of Minnesota and the capabilities we have, because every time I turn around, I run into something else I didn't know we had. And we have incredible resources and people in this organization, in this state, if we just work together. So this is an area of focus right now, and Pam will cover more of that. So I'm going to stop there before we switch gears. That's just background information, and we'll go into a little bit more detail on each one of these. Are there any questions while we prepare for a change in the guard?
Mr. Wallstrom, I actually have one that I don't think can be answered here, but it's you said 36 incubators, and I was surprised I didn't realize we had that many. And then you said we didn't have any accelerators. I know of the one. I know of a couple that are thinking of it. I would ask that your organization give this committee at some time at a later date some direction on what is needed and what's needed to make a good accelerator and what is needed to get one up and running. Because I know St. Cloud has some proposals for one. I know there's a proposal for one here in the metro area. And we'd like to ensure that they do a good job, and if there's a state involvement, we do it correct rather than just kind of take a stab in the dark. So I don't think you can answer that, but it'd be great for us, because I know St. Cloud really could use one or wants one, and I'd like to be able to help them in a way that makes good sense. So later on.
Okay, Mr. We'll be happy to do that. I want to make you aware, we are not experts in an area. What we would propose to do in that case is bring in two experts in the area of accelerator design and manufacture to talk with you, but we'll do that later.
I think okay. That works.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We would appreciate it from St. Cloud, that's for sure.
Yeah. Well, I know St. Cloud is really working hard at it, so.
Yep. Okay.
I encourage
that. Any other questions?
Any questions from the committee? Thank you.
Very well, thank you. So now I'm going to introduce the topic of modeling. And we're breaking this up into two parts because Steve Kelly, who you all know, has another commitment and has to leave. So we're going to, as you might recall, last year we talked about at the request of the committee, we were looking at the creation of modeling capability within the state, as well as producing a model for renewable fuels, or renewable energy rather. In taking that request out, the Humphrey Institute, specifically with Steve Kelly and Mari Munson and Jennifer Kuzma, who's not here, but Steve and Mari are going to come up and talk about the piece of trying to establish local capability to do advanced systems dynamic modeling so that you don't always have to go to the East Coast or West Coast every time we need help in this area. So with that, I'll turn it over to the two of them.
Good to see you again. Thank you for coming today.
Mr. Chairman, it's nice to see you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Steve Kelly. I'm a senior fellow at the Humphrey Institute of Public Affairs, and I'm the director of the University Center for Science, Technology, and Public Policy. And the center's mission is to improve people's lives by improving how we apply science and technology to solving public problems. We're excited for that reason to be in a collaboration with the Biobusiness Alliance of Minnesota on how we can use biological tools to improve people's lives. And so we appreciate the opportunity to talk a little bit about a tool that I learned about first by talking to Mr. Wallstrom, and which I have come to believe is important from a public policy point of view, but I also realized that there were limits to what I knew about it and that I better bring somebody who had hands-on experience with it. So I'd like to introduce Mari Munson, who's a second-year student in the Humphreys Master of Science in Science, Technology, and Environmental Policy program. And Ms. Munson's actually been working with systems dynamic models and also at the Biobusiness Alliance.
Mr. Chair, I'm Mari Munson.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. I worked this past summer and past year with the Biobusiness Alliance of Minnesota on the renewable energy model, and I had a brief introduction to system dynamics modeling as an undergraduate. So what I'd like to tell you today is, from the student perspective, why I think system dynamics modeling and our modeling center initiative is important. And I also want to give you a brief update as to what we've been working on with the system dynamics modeling initiative. So what strikes me about system dynamics modeling as a tool is that it's very useful, particularly for public policy issues, in part because it looks at problems from a systemic structure, so you can address a variety of issues that are all interacting together at once in order to make better policy. And the other issue that I think is very beneficial is that system dynamics modeling gives you the opportunity to look at potential unintended consequences, which again I think is very important from a policymaking perspective. So in addition to working with the Biobusiness Alliance of Minnesota on this modeling initiative, I've decided to utilize system dynamics modeling for my master's thesis. I'm doing a policy analysis of biofuel policy for the state of Minnesota, specifically looking at renewable fuel standards compared to a low-carbon fuel standard with regards to CO2 emissions and other economic and social issues. And again, I'm utilizing this tool in my thesis. So I think that students in a variety of fields would find it beneficial to have access to this kind of tool to give them the opportunity to make better policies or better decisions, whether it's in private sector, public sector, nonprofit. So far, we have conducted a number of interest group meetings just to kind of get people in the community engaged in system dynamics modeling. Current topics that we've looked at our last interest group meeting, we had Steve Taff of the Applied Economics Department at the University of Minnesota present on his use of system dynamics modeling as a tool looking at the electricity sector, particularly in the upper Midwest region. And he used the tool to help stakeholders understand what the impact of different policy changes would be on CO2 emissions from the electricity sector and also on prices of electricity, percentage from renewables, et cetera. This slide, I think, is really interesting because it just shows you the variety of people that have been interested and have attended our initial system dynamics interest group meetings. So you can see there's a variety of departments from the University of Minnesota. We've had some government representatives. We've had a variety of nonprofit and private sector. And again, I think this just shows you the variety of the interest in this type of modeling tool. And I also want to let you know we're working on future interest group meetings, also trying to put together some workshops. And one that might be of particular interest to you all is a June 2008 one-day workshop that's targeted at legislative staffers on system dynamics modeling for policy analysis and decisions. And this would include both basic concepts in system dynamics modeling and then hopefully some opportunity to do some hands-on work within the modeling tools. Thank you.
And, Ms. Chairman, I just want to reinforce a couple points that Ms. Munson made. I think we've all, you know, the longer you spend in the legislature, the clearer it becomes that things don't work in linear ways. They tend to loop back at you. And there are feedback mechanisms in natural systems as well as in systems that people create. And so systems dynamic modeling helps you try to think about what those feedback loops might look like and trying to think about all the different components of the system that legislature might be trying to affect. And I think all of you have heard about the law of unintended consequences. I don't think that there is a law, but it's all too frequent that failure to think about feedback effects may lead to unintended consequences, and I think it's really important for policymakers to have a systematic approach, a structured way to try to find out in advance what those potential feedback problems might be. And the other thing that excites me about the systems dynamic modeling approach is that it gives you a structured way of trying to identify the pieces of the system where you can call on experts. But if you're really going to understand the whole system, you also have to probably call on citizens, on folks on the street, people who've got hands-on experience with the certain parts of the system. So to do it right, it should be a very inclusive, not just expert-based process, but one that brings citizens into it as well. And so it's a way of bridging sometimes the divide between an expert point of view and the public's point of view on how to look at a problem. Because we're convinced about the value of this, the center is putting resources into the kinds of workshops and ideas that Ms. Munson has already talked about. We're raising money to bring a visiting faculty member to the Humphrey Institute who would be an expert in systems dynamic modeling. And then the dean is committed to working with central administration to establishing, we hope by 2009 or 2010. The other thing I learned is how slowly things work in academia since I started there. But in 2009 or 2010, we hope to have a full-time permanent faculty member whose expertise is in systems dynamic modeling so that resource is available to the legislature as well as to business organizations in Minnesota. We recognize that this isn't just useful in the policy context, but also in the business context. And I think you saw on Ms. Munson's slide about the folks who are interested in this, that there are a number of private sector businesses that are interested as well.
Mr. Kelly, Senator Kelly, I think the law of unintended consequences is called cleanup bills the year after.
Mr. Chairman, if you're here, I certainly found out that getting it right on the first try is often very hard, and that the opportunity for the legislature to come back and improve its earlier product is a good thing.
Tactfully said. It is interesting, and I'll open it up for questions if there are any, but I'm excited about the idea of the system dynamic model being open not just to the legislative and policymakers, but to private business, and to make that connection with the university for business, because that is, although the university has been making a much greater effort at connecting with businesses, it is something that has rubbed business kind of a little bit the wrong way, and it's now just starting to turn around. And that's a real plus tool for the university to go out to businesses and say, this is what, you know, if you change the signage on your store, what's the difference? What are the consequences of doing that? Or if you go into this avenue of business, what's the likely effect on your current avenue of business? So I'm very excited about that particular. Any questions from the committee on this part of the presentation? Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe I missed this part, but I know that one of the goals of the legislation we passed last year to create the model and to provide the funding to go under the renewable energy model was that we want to build capacity in Minnesota. But the center that you're working on, or is it the center that you're working on? Does that still require us to go to Sandia Labs in order to actually do the work? Is it more of a collaborative process that you put together at Humphrey, and then you actually take kind of the inputs and you take them to Sandia to get the results?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Winkler, my sense of it is that certainly to do the current model, because we don't have in Minnesota the expertise on the subject, the Biobusiness Alliance has used outside organizations. And I think if we get one faculty member here, that's a really good start, and hopefully from that it'll grow. And as Ms. Munson pointed out, we have faculty members at the university who are already using systems dynamic modeling for pieces of their research. So by creating a focus point for systems dynamics and its role in policy at the Humphrey Institute, we think we'll be able to have a point of collaboration that will expand our capacity. Now, I couldn't guarantee to you that for building some future model, we might not need additional resources from outside the state, but at least we'd have a place to start in Minnesota, determine the size of the project and what was needed, and hopefully provide all the resources necessary to prepare that kind of model.
Representative Bunn.
Chair and former Senator Kelly, having worked in academia, the issue about hiring someone specific to fill a niche to be the expert in systems modeling, as you just mentioned, I'm sure there, my own dissertation was systems modeling, you know, in the years ago. And it seems like there are people all throughout the university who are engaged in systems modeling within their fields. And they typically have, that's how you publish and that's how you advance yourself in a particular field. And I'm wondering to what extent you've explored whether it's even possible, given the structure of academia and how it's rewarded in the past, to hire someone specifically just to kind of be a generalist systems modeling expert that would lend to public policy. Is that something that's even feasible within the marketplace in academia?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Bunn, until we are doing the search for a full-time faculty member, that's a really good question. But here's what we think we know so far. Professor Kuzma, who is the faculty member who's been leading the work on this, has worked with a couple other people around the country, and of those, some of them have expressed an interest in potentially being a visiting faculty member and helping us along that sort of next step in this process. And then we've visited with one of the SD experts at MIT, who feels that it's possible to build up this capacity in Minnesota, but you need to do it in a step-by-step process, mm-hmm. which we think we're pursuing. So the folks that we've talked to indicate that they think it's doable, and I think the chairman's point about this relationship between policy and business is important. The Humphrey Institute has, with the Carlson School of Management, has, and the University Central Administration has just created the Center for Integrative Leadership. Mm-hmm. And I think we're starting to pay attention to this issue of how you bridge the gap between the policy side and the business side. And we may not, you know, in doing the search, we may want to include the Carlson School of Management as a split home or something like that for the person that we would be seeking to hire.
Senator Kelly, thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for your time.
I'm trying to stay the schedule here. Thank you, Ms. Munson. I appreciate
thank
it.
You.
Good luck with your studies.
Representative Bunn, I might add that the only place I know in the United States, and there may be more, that has policy-related SBUs, University of New York and Albany. They have a program specifically around there.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we're going to switch gears now and move into the Biobusiness Resource Network. This was the third stage of our initiative. And I might add, Representative Winkler, we'll come back to the specifics around the energy piece in a little bit later. But the BRN is the, what we call the BRN, is the third stage of the initiative. There are two parts to it. First is we take on and manage very large programs, of which the life science community is one example. The other is we work with companies to, and we'll talk a bit more about that later. But today, I'm going to ask Pam Bishop from the Minnesota Initiative Foundation to come down and talk about a pilot program we have going with them to take the life science community around the state. And then what we'll do is we'll introduce one more person in a minute to talk about one of the specific projects. So, Ms. Bishop.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank
Please
you,
state your name for the record.
Thank you. My name is Pam Bishop. I'm with the Southern Minnesota Initiative Foundation. I'm the Emerging Business Officer for the work that we do there. So again, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee for the invitation. We are extremely excited about the work that lies ahead with the Biobusiness Alliance regarding the Biobusiness Resource Network. Thank you. This morning, I would like to share with all of you the work that we will be involved with in supporting this with the Biobusiness Alliance, including how the partnership was launched and initiated. I'd like to share with you some of the process overviews and how we expect to gather this information and the expected outcomes as a result of this work. Just to provide you with a little background about who we are, first of all, there are six initiative foundations in the state representing Greater Minnesota. We represent the southeast corner of the state, and our next 5 years includes an emphasis on business and workforce, but especially in the areas of biomedical, bioagriculture, and renewable energy. So it makes a lot of sense for us to align our work with a significant partner such as the Biobusiness Alliance. Again, we cover 20 counties in the southeast corner of the state. That includes 175 communities. Again, we are one of six initiative foundations in the state that were started back in 1986 through the McKnight Foundation. 1 year ago, as we began to explore how we can most effectively do our work in growing biobusinesses in Greater Minnesota, it became evident that we needed to have conversations to explore how to support the Biobusiness Resource Network. The McKnight Foundation stepped forward and suggested that we make an application in partnership with the Biobusiness Alliance to support a 3-year project that would allow us to begin inventorying and understanding the capabilities that we have in Greater Minnesota to support the growth, expansion, and recruitment of bioscience industries in the state. With the leadership of the Biobusiness Alliance team, the Southern Minnesota Initiative Foundation partnered with the Alliance to make that application, and in November we were successfully awarded $500,000 to complete this 3-year project, knowing that we'll have to leverage other financial resources and partnerships to fully fulfill this 3-year partnership. Along with that, the Mayo Clinic has recognized the importance of this work and the significance of growing opportunities that support the commercialization of bioscience. They have since provided us funding of $50,000 to support this project, along with another $50,000 to support other kinds of work related to growing bio in the southeastern corridor of our state.
Bishop, if I could just interrupt you just for just a moment, committee members and members in the audience that follow public policy, I'd like you to join me in welcoming the Farmington Middle School students. Hopefully you're getting some idea of public policy and how breathtakingly exciting it is. It is an important part of your education to understand how you are governed and how we come to policy decisions. It takes a lot of mundane listening to make some pretty good ideas for tomorrow, and this is part of it, and I didn't mean to insult anybody by saying mundane, but I think you all get my drift. We are not the most exciting bunch, but in the end, hopefully we come up with good policy, and we're glad to have you here. Thank you for coming and joining us today.
Thank you, Bishop. Mr. Chairman. Along with the other stakeholders that are important to the three-year project, our economic developers and community leaders, I will explain to you a little bit later here as to how their involvement is so key to the outcomes of this project. We've also been successful in bringing on a CAP student through the University of Minnesota this spring. Karen Moe will participate in the inventory analysis of gathering this information that will allow us to recognize those capabilities. And I'd like you to keep thinking about that chart that Dale Wallstrom provided to you early on. This is really what we're going to be inventorying and understanding at a greater level in greater Minnesota. So how will we do this? How will we make sure that we're finding what we don't know today? And the Initiative Foundations have been very successful in using what was created by John McKnight from Northwestern University and focusing in on our assets. In other words, looking at asset-based community development as a way to understand what we have versus what we don't have. Oftentimes, we talk a lot about our deficiencies and try to create things that technically we just don't have. So we need to start exploring and discovering what we do have as a state and to understand how those hubs and notes can meet each one of them together and start leveraging those resources across the state so that we can better share that knowledge and equip our startup companies and our economic developers and those companies that want to join us as a state in the bioscience industry. So we have actually started that process in the high-level inventory work that we are doing and will continue to do throughout the state in preparation for the bio show in June in San Diego. This will allow the Bio Business Alliance, as well as everyone who joins in that effort, to be able to provide real information based on a real understanding of what we have as a state based on this early activity. We also will begin doing in-depth asset mapping so that we can further peel that onion to understand how do we continue to leverage those resources, and by doing this, we create what we call a business resource network, an integrated system that allows any one of us at any time to leverage those resources, whether it's technical, whether it's funding, whether it's infrastructure, whether it's research. And again, as a whole, we can share those resources versus trying to work individually, which for a long time, communities and economic developers have been forced to do. And so we hope that this system will allow us to overcome those individual lives that we have as economic developers and communities and start looking at ourselves as a region and even more so as a state to begin growing those early stage companies, expanding what we do have, and recruiting those companies that do find opportunities in the state of Minnesota. I should also note that we will be hiring a bio business specialist network individual. We're in the process of interviewing those folks that have made applications. We believe it will be instrumental for this individual to have background in commercialization, who will have an understanding of bio and perhaps more importantly have worked in the industry, so that they can support, or that he or she can support communities that truly want to build a strategy based on the assets that they have and based on the partnerships and based on all the resources that we discover as part of this asset mapping process that we hope to complete over the next 3 years. We are talking to all the initiative foundations in the state. We're hopeful that they will be a significant partner to help lead and pave the way for the BioBusiness Alliance to do their work. And the conversations that we're having to date in most of the communities and all the communities that we're talking to seem to suggest that people are eager for this process because they, too, want to understand how they can contribute to bioscience, how they can leverage the resources that they have in their communities, but just as important to understand how they can partner with other organizations and other institutions that make a difference in how we'll shape the state of Minnesota related to bioscience. So at the end of the day, what will occur as a result of all this work? As I've mentioned, business development and aligning our partnerships are so key to how we work together. Creating an effective and a rapid transfer of statewide technical and support systems will be key as well. You know, no company wants to wait for information. No company wants to be put on hold as you try to gather that information. So we want to be prepared and be in a position to be able to generate the kind of information companies are looking for and that they deserve to have, whether they're starting up in our state, whether they're expanding in our state, or whether they're coming to our state. And as a result, we truly believe that this system approach will allow us to have an integrated system and, most important, sustainable. This will allow us to continue to map the regions as we need to, and it will allow us to have a system that's sustainable for the long-term viability of the state of Minnesota related to bioscience. Thank you.
Any questions?
Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I was listening to your testimony and looking over your partnership list, it seems a natural and probably just a given that you work with the SBDCs in the communities.
Yes, we do.
And are they part of the partnership group that you've been pulling together, or how do you work with them?
Yes, they, in fact, are part of our stakeholders list. As we work with communities, we are trying to identify key stakeholders that should be at the table. We're looking for technical experts in the field. So obviously these are organizations that are well represented in our state who work with startup companies, and they are more than likely going to be part of the conversations that we'll have across the state of Minnesota.
Chair? As long as you're here, and Mr. Wallstrom as well. One of the issues that we often hear is that there are, going back to your original chart, the very baseline of education infrastructure and policy, that there are perhaps some needs in the infrastructure area, in particular with technology. Have you seen those needs throughout the state? And
Go ahead. Yeah, Representative Norton, there are gaps. There are gaps in acceleration, and we haven't defined that, but we can do that at another date. There are gaps in funding. There are gaps in our ability, especially in the area of commercialization of biotech or biologic-based products. There are gaps in facility capability, and we're trying to do, and as part of Destination 2025, which you will hear about in just a few minutes from Steve, that we're trying to identify and be very specific to say these are the areas where we need very targeted investment, either from the public or private sector. You know, it won't all be from the public. A lot of it is private sector as well. So the answer is yes, and without going into great detail on discussion.
Representative Ruth?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In just talking about the support for biosciences, I'm wondering what percentage for the Southern Minnesota NISBE Foundation goes to support those businesses? Is there still the support for businesses that are starting other ventures?
Mr. Chair and Representative Ruth, yes, in fact, in regards to how we're positioning ourselves as an NISBE Foundation, we do have a lending pool. It's not a big lending pool, about $1.3 million that we can target to industries. And we have specifically said that we would like 75% of those dollars to go towards supporting bio initiatives. Am I answering your question?
Yes.
Okay.
Right.
Yes,
thank you. And are you looking to try to also have that throughout the state? I certainly support biosciences, but I am hearing some conversation from people around the state who are concerned if they're in other businesses that they're not receiving the same level of support that they did in the past.
Chairman and Representative Ruth, each initiative foundation is run separately. So each initiative foundation will determine where they will place their emphasis. So I cannot speak on behalf of those foundations or the other resources those regions may have to support bioscience. I would have to think, and Dale's team has done much more research than I have in terms of what's available out there beyond our region, but I would have to think that there are specialty areas of bioscience, for example, the Southwestern Foundation, renewable energy, wind energy is very much a focused area. And so they're spending significant time and dollars to support that work there. So every region is different and probably has a special niche related to bioscience. Ours just happens to be in the medical and agriculture because of the resources that we do have. It really makes sense that we touch upon those two areas.
Thank you.
Okay.
If you have no other questions, I suspect we can move on.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Fisher.
Okay, we are running behind schedule.
Yes.
So we're going to ask all the upcoming presenters to move more quickly, starting with me. I'll ask Mr. Lemons to come up here and get ready. What we're going to talk about, I'm going to go through so quickly you can't believe it, is an organization we call the International Business Support Center, the IBSC. The IBSC, if you look on that colorful graph we gave you, it's the yellow arrow. It's targeted at trying to bring companies from overseas to investments from overseas into Minnesota. We targeted that because when we look at a niche, we decided that trying to understand where we could really leverage our skills and take advantage of needs, we identified that it's a very possible opportunity was trying to identify startup and small companies that need to enter the U.S. market because the U.S. market in the area of biology. Biology-based products represents about 52 to 54% of the global market. So all companies need to come here at some point, unless they want to stay small. So we leveraged that, and let me just summarize by saying this, that we signed a memorandum of understanding with Uppsala, Sweden, which is a targeted, it's a very advanced area of biological-based businesses. We are negotiating with Japan, and it's back in my lap to finish that proposal, and they're ready to sign it once I get it in writing. We're talking with Scotland and Canada to do the same. So far, we signed our first agreement in August. We have one company coming from Sweden. We've hired a student from Sweden who will be helping with the transfer. That person will move here in the end of March. And we'll begin that process. They will be here, their team will be here in the summer for site selection, and sometime later this year, summer, early fall, for site selection. We had a teleconference yesterday. There's a team of three managers and two companies coming from Sweden again. Sometime within the next 2 months, to assess the possibility of establishing U.S. operations for those two companies in Minnesota, to enter the U.S. market, and with that I'll stop. It's just an area that we have found to be a very high level of interest because of the personal nature in which of service that we're providing to these groups. And before I turn it over to Mr. Lemon, I would like to just comment briefly on the in fact, I'll hold it. So now what I'd like to do is speed through this, and you can read if you have questions, and introduce Mr. Richard Lemons, who is on contract with us from a company called PLS, stands for Project Leadership Services, and which, by the way, I would highly recommend that organization. It's a group of very seasoned people who provide very experienced management skills, so it's been very helpful to us in donating their services as well. So, Mr. Lemons.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Waltram.
Thank you, Mr. Lemons. Welcome to the committee.
Thank
you. Identify yourself for the record.
Thank you. My name is Richard Lemons, and as Mr. Waltram said, I am a consultant in the area of project leadership, and I work through the company Project Leadership Services. Specifically, my role in this particular project has been to lead a group of representatives, people coming from the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities system, Minnesota State University Mankato, Minnesota Department of Economic Development, Employment and Economic Development, representatives from the Biobusiness Alliance and some private sector people in the development of a competitive proposal on behalf of the state of Minnesota to establish here an institute focused on the topic of renewable energy. As the slide indicates, the U.S. Ambassador Michael Woods observed some companies in Sweden that had become very successful in developing and implementing technology in the area of renewable energy. The work of Ambassador Woods was to go around and do a lot of development of relationships, ultimately resulting in a committee being formed made up of people from both Sweden and the United States who put together a request for proposal. That request for proposal went out to a lot of states. I'm not exactly sure how many, but a number of states, of which six states developed intensive proposals, and three now have been shortlisted for being potential states in which the institute would be established. The states that are now in competition are the states of Minnesota, New York, and Georgia. Specifically in Minnesota, it's Minnesota State University, Mankato, is our focal point. In New York, it's New York State University in Albany. And in Georgia, it's the University of Georgia in Athens. The basic concept that we put forward in our proposal was twofold. One, to establish a for-profit entity, and that for-profit entity will be focused on the commercialization issues, finding and qualifying of partners in the United States to work with Swedish companies, and really to establish then the opportunity to make and sell products in the state of Minnesota. The not-for-profit organization would be responsible for applied research, for a lot of the testing and development of different testing methods that would be required, and ultimately for the advancement of the technology. There's some 23 companies today that are still active in this from Sweden who have signed up actually as participants from the Swedish perspective. And those 23 companies have a lot of different technologies ranging from a lot about biomass and burning of biomass to the wind and other technologies in the renewable area. Minnesota State University, as a representative of MinSCU, really is the host of this, and we're looking at the reason that we chose Minnesota State University Mankato was because it has a rich history in partnering with industry. In fact, there's a center there called the Center for Engineering and Manufacturing Excellence that's been founded there. There's a process in place already for establishing centers, and it looked really it right and interesting for this particular opportunity. The physical and human resources are in place, and it's an opportunity for us to leverage a lot of things that already exist. The benefits to the state of Minnesota are jobs. We anticipate that as this institute is founded and as the for-profit component of it is launched, that jobs will be launched in the state of Minnesota and will be developed, and that companies, in fact, have an opportunity to spring up. And I think if we looked at the medical device area as an example of how that's happened in the past, I think that's a reasonable expectation. Just a little bit about the benefits that have been recognized from these technologies in Sweden. The carbon footprint was actually reduced by 7%, while the economy grew at 39%. So the obvious factor there is that they were effective in bringing down carbon emissions. There's also a reduction, obviously, in petroleum-based energy development and an increase in economic growth. Ambassador Woods and his team found 39 companies that really developed that technology, and we're continuing to develop relationships at this point with those companies. The status on the activity now is that the site selection team has made the trip to all three states, having come here Monday for a visit. And they are in the process now of making a difficult decision of which state to choose to place the institute. We, of course, anticipate it will be Minnesota. I'm open for questions at this time.
Are there any questions from the committee? Mr. Bunn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What is the relationship or potential future relationship, if any, between this effort, the institute, and the potential Mankato connection to Erie at the University of Minnesota? I mean, what's the difference? What would be their role versus the role of this new organization at Mankato, et cetera? If you could elaborate on that.
Yes.
That's relatively new as well and seems to be taking off. So it was just, yeah.
Right. Mr. Chairman, Representative Bunn, in fact, our proposal included a direct connection to Erie, and as part of our site visit activity that took place on Monday, we toured the University of Minnesota, and Dean Eldy conducted the tour through that component of their work. So it is anticipated there will be a direct connection. The expectation is that most of the work will be applied research and not basic research, but there is an anticipation there will be a component that will be basic research, and for that, there's a direct connection between Minnesota State University of Mankato and the University of Minnesota here in the Twin Cities.
Okay. Thank you.
So it becomes obvious that some colleges work better with other colleges than others. Mr. Lemon, thank you for coming to the committee today, and thank you for your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, we're going to switch now, and I'll be asking for our partner from Deloitte, Mr. Steve Dahl, to join me. Destination 2025, as you know, is our 20-year visiting program to develop a white paper and roadmap, but I'll let Mr. Dahl talk about that.
Great. Thank you, Dale, and thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members, for having me here today, and excited to give you a quick overview of the Destination 2025 effort and Deloitte Consulting's role in it. I'm Steve Dahl with Deloitte Consulting here in Minneapolis. I lead our public sector practice for the Midwest region. Just to put in perspective for everyone here of Deloitte Consulting, we have about our office here, we have about 900 people, about 30,000 people here in the U.S., and about 150,000 people globally. And we're bringing key resources to this this effort that I'll describe as we move along. Destination 2025 has a few key deliverables that I'd like to highlight. First, we're in the process right now of developing six white papers and six roadmaps for Minnesota in each of the industries that are listed up here: medical devices, pharma, biologics, animal health, food, renewable energy, and biomaterials. So these white papers really look at kind of what's the current state or status of the respective industry, what are some of the things that are going on in this industry, technologies, discoveries, different movements within the market that we should be aware of as we're thinking about longer-term strategies and visions for Minnesota's position in the respective industries. What are some of the constraints that would limit growth as well as provide opportunities for Minnesota? Risks and uncertainties, and then also what are the collaborative opportunities that we should really be looking at as a state to harvest as we go forward? And then lastly, focusing on what are the our status of talent, talent development, what are some of the gaps that are there, as Dale mentioned previously, and what are some of the things we need to do right now to start closing those gaps by investment in developing people, developing capabilities, and developing businesses. So that's really the focus of what we're pulling together on the white papers and also then ultimately into a roadmap that will provide policy recommendations for academia, government, and industry to look at how do we how do we move forward as a state over the next many years. So I'd like to also just say that it's really a pleasure to be involved in this process. We started working with BioBusiness Alliance Minnesota in January of this year, and I think what you're doing and what you put together to really take a long-term view of this marketplace and how to how Minnesota can be positioned in here is a great thing, and it's something that I'm proud to be part of, and also really happy to see that that you've taken on. Our timeline again is that we're going to be have in the fall of 08 through the summer of 09, we'll have documents that will start to be distributed for broader public review. How are we going about doing this or pulling this together? Basically, a five-step process starts with drafting. So we have a thought leader who puts together an initial draft of a white paper. Working with us and with BioBusiness Alliance and the core governance board there to put together an initial straw paper. Then we take that draft and we run it through a variety of reviews, through additional thought leaders, as well as through then our Deloitte Center of Practice Experts, where we look at who are some of the experts we have nationally and globally that can really provide a point of view on this and help in the process. Once we have that, then we take these documents and we're going to put it out for those first two steps are in process right now. Once we have it, then we start putting these out for broader input and analysis. So we're conducting surveys and broader analysis of markets, collecting that data and really looking to pull together from that broad input then a final document that we use for smaller group discussions and looking at the specific options that exist for us going forward. And then finally, we pull together in step five a series of recommendations that I talked about in the last slide and roadmaps for us moving forward. So moving to the next slide, I just wanted to give you a flavor of the core teams that are working on this and what that looks like. First, you'll recognize the players, most players on this group. It's the chairs and the leadership group from BioBusiness Alliance, and then from Deloitte, our core team that is driving this work, myself, Casey Healy, who is our national leader for our alternative energy initiative within Deloitte, and Casey's behind me, if you could stand up, Casey. And also then Rehan Malik, who's from Minneapolis, who's our project manager on this initiative as well. Moving into the kind of what do these panels look like that I described that are providing this input and analysis from Deloitte, you'll see we're bringing in each industry segment, from biopharma in this example, examples and people, thought leaders from our national and global practice to provide perspective, thoughts, and direction around this. And then the same is true, you see here an example in renewable energy and what we're bringing and the kind of team that we're putting together there. From academic and industry participants, again, these are just examples of the people that are already involved that give you a flavor for the kind of input this process is now taking on. So this is in the food industry, and you'll see a good mix of government, academia, and industry participants, both from Minnesota and also from national points of view as well. And then very similarly with renewable materials and the type of experts that are being pulled together to deliver this effort. So that's a quick snapshot of Destination 2025, where it is right now, who's involved, the process that we're utilizing to pull this together, and what some of the timing and expected outcomes are. At this point, I'll stop for questions.
Mr. Dahl, my one question is, there's a significant push at the legislature this year to expand into green manufacturing and policy making, as that might affect green manufacturing. Would your white papers help us with some insight into that? And just on a personal note, will they all have executive summaries? Please.
You don't want the 100-page documents?
I'd love to have them, but I'd also like to have the executive summary.
Mr. Chairman, on the second point first, on the executive summary, absolutely. We'll provide executive summaries. And secondly, on any of the aspects around, I'll call it around green, those are things we're looking at very broadly. So, yeah.
Good. Any other questions? Representative Winkler?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm just wondering about how these work as functional documents. I mean, if we're talking about kind of a market segment and where Minnesota stacks up there, as you know, as your sheet there shows, there are so many ways that we influence this as policymakers and the business community. What's the market for your white paper, ultimately?
The papers will be designed to have aspects of them that are targeted for the different audiences, whether it be academia, as we look at workforce development, or the private sector for areas of potential interest that they... We'd be very careful not to make specific recommendations for any kind of private sector investment, but rather try to make an awareness about where private sector opportunities might reside. Is it back to the initial question that Representative Norton had a few minutes ago about recommendations for investment for infrastructure? It out of it, we will be able to identify where Minnesota has strength and where it has holes in its capability, so we can make recommendations around specific things such as GMP manufacturing facilities, which we know we need right now, as one example for drugs and pharma. So there will be a overall industry view and a very specific paper targeted at Minnesota within each one of these categories. Did that answer your question, Christian?
Mr. Chair, I believe it did answer my question, though I'm not sure I still get it, but we can talk about it.
Okay, good.
Are there any other questions? Or Mr. Olson, do you have more to ask?
No, I think we actually have to move on because we're really short on time. And we know you want to see models, so we're going to do that. And I want to thank the entire Deloitte team for coming here today. Thank you, Steve.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Okay. I have next on the list Greg Mass.
Yes.
Is that correct?
That is correct.
All right. We're ready to move on.
Yep. Okay, what we're going to do now, while Greg is getting set up, is I'm going to give you a little background on what Greg is going to show to you. What we have, the last item on the agenda today is demonstrating the model. But I want to be really clear about that model development is, the model that we've developed around this is, again, a system dynamic model, which Steve Kelly talked about. The model covers the following areas. In the sake of time, I'm not going to go through them, but it's basically the five federal level categories that are defined in federal data. And then the bottom are the measurements that come out of that. So when you look at a model, it gives you an outcome based on a series of inputs. The model was developed by bringing together a group of experts from around the state. That list is on there. You can see it covers everybody from producers to government, academics, and whatnot, and everybody in the middle, actually. And these are the people who are recognized experts in their industry in the state. What they did is meet for a series of several months to try to pull together all of the data and the information, the insights that are necessary to complete the model, which Greg will show you in a moment. What you're going to see today, this is because we do not have internet connection in this room, we're not able to show you the online version. So what we've done is we're going to show you the modeler's version, the model actually that the person, the expert who is doing the programming, will use to do it and demonstrate that to you. And then we'll use hard copy overhead of slides to demonstrate what it would look like had we had internet connection so we could demonstrate it to you. So that's really it in a nutshell. A couple of, and you'll see that in a minute, and it actually works very well because a point I haven't made and I probably should make very, very clearly is that the model is only a tool. Everybody wants to look at a model and hope it'll give you the magic answer. I assure you, no model gives you the answer. All models do is give you insights. And it's with the insights you still need people to sit around and figure out what to do with that, with those insights to make a decision or a policy decision. And I think that's what Representative Bunn was alluding to earlier as well.
Well, those are awesome. I think we appreciate that. We didn't want to be out of jobs.
Okay. So to give you some background information, we will, this is just four slides, which I'm going to go through quickly. This is a picture of the national transportation fuel consumption as projected by we have some sequencing problems. So this is a natural transportation fuel consumption slide, which is put out by the EIA. It shows you the bottom line, the blue area is gasoline. It shows you that even though with all our work in renewable energy, they're not predicting that our growth or demand decreases. It just slows in growth. This is a Minnesota picture, the same thing, even here. It still shows we have a growth in demand for basic petroleum-based products. This is two graphs we have showing national electricity production. This is you can see the renewables coming out on the top line, but again, electricity is still going to be based primarily on fossil fuels, namely coal. this is a Minnesota picture of that same thing. And here you can see on the bottom, which is the blue, is renewable for us. You can see in Minnesota we have significantly more impact on demand in area of renewables, but even there, we don't reduce our dependence very much as we look out to the future. Okay, a couple quick things on modeling, and that is that modeling is all planning is based on models, whether those are mental models or computer models. And in this particular case, what we try to do with systems dynamic model is take all the various mental models that each of you have and try to integrate it into an interactive system so you can look at subsystem interaction to integrate those models into one computer model. Every time we run a model, every time we run a scenario, we have to ask these three questions. First one is this model showing you data that was unintended, and is it teaching us something? The second thing it asks, is the model incorrect because it has incorrect data in it? And the third one is the model incorrect because there's something wrong with the structure? We finished the model about 3 months ago. So the last 3 months, we've been going through what's called validation, which is to take out as much possibility of there being a model problem in the structure of the model, namely item number 3. So we, at this stage of the game, feel like we have a model that works. We will still find problems in it as we go forward because it's very complex. But it's at the point now where, an analogy I used yesterday and explained to somebody else is this. We're talking about a car. We're building the first car. We have the engines running, transmission works. We've got a howl somewhere in the back end we need to figure out. And we have an air conditioner that's not working. So there are certain pieces still need to be fixed, but the car still works just like the model is still working here. What you'll see is that. The second thing we found is that there's a lot of data problems. And the what's good about that and bad about that is that's the same data that you are using today to make decisions. And it's filled with errors. It's filled with inconsistencies. But it's the same information that's out there. So what we're trying to do is when we identify that is go back, work with the academics to get the right information to fill in the gap. And every once in a while, already we're running into unintended outcomes, and we'll show you one of those today. All right, so the only point I'm going to make on this slide is that the model that we're running is what's called unconstrained, and it's a base case. And unconstrained means that we're not limited. We will have all the money necessary to build a renewable energy industry in the state of Minnesota. Money will not be a problem. We'll have all the workforce we need. That won't be a problem. We'll have all the research problems will be solved, so that'll be resolved. Now, we all know that that is not realistic, that that's not what will really happen. But in order to establish a baseline, you need to unconstrain it and then gradually go back in and solve the problems to put the proper constraints around it to give you an answer. So the data you're going to see today is based on unconstrained assumptions with the exception of those data points that the team put together. And I want to just point out one of them. In fact, the way the process works, as we brought these experts together, you have people in the, as Mr. Kelly pointed out, you have to have people from every part of the system. You need to have environmentalists in the room. You need to have the local producers, the growers, everybody that's involved in making policy or impacted by it needs to be part of it. If you're missing a piece of it, then your model will be invalid. So, as an example, the team then debates it, comes up with what they call base case. And the numbers that you're showing here are numbers that are in the model that this team agreed are reasonable. So, as an example, in the case of corn yield growth rate, 2%. Is what's in the model today. But when we first raised this point to the team, we had one group in a room who said, "That's crazy. We're going to hit 3.5 to 4% growth every year in increase in corn yield." Another group said, "No, it's not. Those are the days that are over. We're now into it. We melt as much of that as we possibly can. It's going to be more like 1%." So after a large amount of debate, we got the group to agree 2% is reasonable. That's probably achievable. It could happen. 4% probably won't. 1% probably won't either. But 2, okay. But the value of the model is you can then go in and change it and run the 4%, or you can run the 1%. And you'll see in some of the stuff, Greg, those kinds of questions have tremendous variation with outcomes and the decisions that you would make. So with that, I'm going to go through this. These are the rest of the assumptions. The wind targets are based on legislation. The rest of them are best judgments by the team. Construction time is based on historical data. And with that, I will turn it over to Greg Mast, who will demonstrate the model to you. Okay?
Greg. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Greg Mast, Senior Program Manager at the Biobusiness Alliance of Minnesota. The approach that I'd like to take today to walk you through the model is from a perspective of a bottom-up approach. And so the way I'd like to do this is first start and show you an insight into where the data source is. And currently the data resides in multiple Excel spreadsheet formats. And I will show you a very brief look into a subset of that data. Then I would like to also show you within Ventum, which is the application software, which the model is residing currently and has been developed. I would like to just show you a view of what the model looks like, the types of systems and the subsets of the systems and how they interact to give you a flavor for the development phase. And then also I would then like to move on to a base case scenario and walk you through how we arrived at a base case, as Mr. Wallstrom had mentioned earlier. And then from there, what I would like to do then is walk through a scenario or two just to show you how the model is able to add value by understanding the decisions and the implications, whether it could be investment or policy-based decisions, to show some varying outcomes and what does that show us. So to begin, I will pop into Excel, and I would also invite members of the audience, perhaps you would like to move a little closer if you'd like to see some of the inner workings of the model. It shows up very small through the overhead. So if you'd like to move, feel free.
Well, he said enough. I might add that this is not an optimum venue to present a model. An optimum venue is a small working group. So we'll do the best we can to allow you to see it.
With internet connection.
And I'm going to ask that at some point you make the offer to have a conversation with members separately an opportunity to actually see someplace where be somewhere where this actually will work because of the computer speed and some of the others, because I suspect that this is going to be fairly longer than the 7 minutes left, so... I'll leave it at that.
We'll move quickly. And we do invite those conversations and invitations to show you in a smaller group setting more of the model itself, and also the user interface, which was developed, which runs online. And that is truly the way that the end user would generally interact with the model. Just to show you some insights, the team that was put together and assembled, they went through and created the data sets that the model runs on. And so currently this is a view of a subset of data. As you can see, there are conversions that are necessary. We then can go through various sectors that you'll see located within the model. I'll just give you a quick overview. Geothermal. We incorporated solar power data. The number of jobs. And just to give you an understanding of where some of these sources are outside of our team of experts, we've also made sure to note where we're pulling these sources of data from. And you'll see that here, in fact, we've went to different national organizations. We've relied on experts that have been identified through the field in helping us perform these calculations and to validate the data that exists currently in the model. So, moving on, in the development world, within the application software of Ventum, which was used to create the model, this is an internal interface which has been developed, which basically shows you each of the subsections of the model. And so to walk through this, I'd like to take a look at the total percent fraction of renewables. And this is the mapping of the relationships within this system. And again, this is just one view of the system outside and with a specific focus on the fraction of renewable energy. And if we show here, you can see the various views that actually incorporate the entire model. And so within each of these views, there are varying maps and setups that look similar to this. Just to give you a very quick overview, in order to calculate the total Minnesota renewable usage, we can see what's feeding that actual calculation. Renewable residential fuel, renewable electricity consumption, renewable commercial fuel, renewable transportation fuel, and renewable industrial fuel. And to go inside, the developer would here is where the internal calculations would take place. Again, pulling from the data sets that were captured and are stored currently in Excel. And then ultimately, if you'd like to see the output, you then have the option, these are the options, to show the fraction of total Minnesota renewable usage. And within the model, this is the output in a graphical format. If you'd like to see the data set, you're able to then click through. And in this particular base case scenario, we're somewhere around 21% total renewable based on the given assumptions that are in place in this version of the model. And from here, using this base case scenario, what I've developed ahead of time here is essentially one scenario that we could run is what would happen if we increase our amount of electricity that is generated from wind. So currently, the mandate sits 25% by 2025. So I've created a scenario around a 5% increase over that mandate by the year 2025. So I've increased that to 30%. So just to show you some sensitivity that you can run in various scenarios, I've now loaded that particular scenario so that we can see how it compares to our base case. And from here, we'll go back to the view which all wind data is captured in. And ultimately, electricity generated from wind. This is just another section of the model. Major output is electricity generated from wind. We can run this output, and you can see the effect of that specific policy change or attribute derived from an increase of 5% in wind production. One of the topics that we'd like to make sure and point out is assuming an increase in wind electricity in that first scenario that I presented compared to base case, let's assume then that we look at if we were to add to the renewable portfolio solar power, for instance. And this is something that in this environment we're able to do. We're very we're lucky that we have the ability to be very agile in what we can pick and choose from in order to incorporate into certain scenarios. And so assuming that we were able to add solar to our renewable portfolio, and I've targeted 15% achieved by 2025 from electricity. I'm going to move this around very quickly. One of the potential outcomes of adding this to the model is in the area of total renewable electricity jobs that are created. Just one of the major outcomes. And so if we were to run this, what we can see is the green line represents base case. Again, that's the scenarios that are right now best developed from our team of experts and from the best data nationwide. We've then ran the scenario, which I showed previously, of 30% of electricity coming by 2025 from that sector. If we added to the portfolio 15% of wind, we can see the job creation in the renewable electric jobs. And the solar line is going to be represented by the red line here, with the 30% represented by the blue line. So things seem to be trending directionally as we would expect. However,
can I make a comment on that one slide, Mr. Chair? This is a great example where how we would use the model, because in this situation, you look at job growth, and you see that in the area of wind, you have tremendous job growth, especially in construction. But then the maintenance and the ongoing repair, as your system gets put in place, those jobs, none of the jobs start to drop off. you take a technology like solar, and according to the literature that's out there about the types of jobs that are created from a different kind of technology, solar has a higher job growth rate than, say, wind long term. Now, the question, then you have to go and say, well, is that even reasonable for Minnesota to think about solar? So you can see you can get into a huge policy kind of discussion around, and this is just one example of potentially thousands of different kinds of questions you could ask in life.
And to Mr. Walton's point that he highlighted there.
There's a question here, if I could. Justin Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Does a model like this, I understand the concept of it, but does it take into effect demographic changes in the community? I mean, you talked about how many jobs would be created. Does it take into effect whether there are even people for those jobs?
Great question. And in fact, maybe we want to do it because we're out of time. Maybe we'll stop the model run because you're asking, this is exactly why you want to do this. Because now you start to ask the policy questions. And maybe, Greg, you can put up that graph of this one graph of jobs. And we'll just talk about that one graph and then we'll put the next one, this one. This particular graph we're putting out there right now happens to be the base case for transportation jobs. So because we unconstrained the model, we ran the model, you look at if we do that, this is what the model said we will need for people to do that. And remember at the beginning I said, hey, we are assuming we have all the people we can get our hands on. Well, Dr. Gail O'Kane is in the audience. She's in part of it. She's with the Ministry of Civil Affairs, and said, okay, this is going to be very difficult. I'm speaking for her now, but is now kicking off a group to start to look at how do you now dig down deeper and find out what is real. And once we do that, and once that team does that, then you can take the new information and put it into the model and you begin to constrain it. Because all of a sudden you're saying, all right, we're going to be limited by workforce. So if you limit by workforce, then you could go back and see then what happens to our performance against percent total renewable. And as you put all these constraints in it, then you get an idea of what is reasonable to achieve given the current limitations. That helps you to make decisions to say, okay, we better do something about and start to look at, in this case, public education from a funding point of view. But it's not like you'll get that answer just by running the model. What you'll get is a picture that says, the first thing you look at it, you say the model must be broken. It can't be right. And then you have to ask those three questions. Is the model wrong? Is the data wrong? Et cetera. And as you prove yourself, the data is correct. And you say, you know, we're learning something here. Then you have to have the dialogue around, from a policy point of view, what do we do to remove that limitation? So you hit the nail on the head with your question as to how to use it.
That sounds like you're asking me to go to another meeting.
Several.
Ms. Mast, Mr. Wallstrom, I hate to cut you off, but I'm going to because we're supposed to end at 11:30. I have a sneaky suspicion that this would be a wonderful field trip for members to or staff to make to your offices to sit down for a morning and go through this. Would you be interested in doing that if members are interested?
We would not only be interested, we'd welcome the opportunity. We recognizing that there's lots of data errors, but we would try to point those out when we find them. Anytime you run these models, you always find problems, and that's why you do it. Because it's the same data that you're making decisions with today. So we would welcome that opportunity and love it. And in closing, may I make a closing comment?
I think Representative Beard has one quick question, and then hopefully we can give you a moment for some closing comments.
I'll try to be brief, but it is a very deep question. It plows very deep, Mr. Wallstrom, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Wallstrom. In looking at the jobs model, it raises a question right away about just what are we trying to do with renewable energy, for instance. And in this particular slide you're looking at, are we trying to incentivize jobs, or are we still interested in productivity per labor hour? One of the things I think that's made us competitive, particularly here in the great upper Midwest over the years, is that particularly when it comes to electrical energy, our productivity per unit of input, whether it's dollars, whether it's fuel, or whether it's labor, has been very, very high. And my fear is, in our rush to embrace the whole renewable crusade, we're losing sight of the fact that one of the most important economic drivers in this whole thing is productivity. And I'm wondering how that fits into your modeling here. If that's a policy question you need us to solve, or are you just making some assumption? I'm bearing in mind this is an unconstrained model you're working with here right now, but when does productivity and efficiency come into the equation?
It's a great question. But in the model itself, there's an actual productivity variable that's been put into the mathematical equation. So based on the experts were saying, all right, we can expect to see, and I don't know the number, but let's assume it's 2% per year increase in productivity. And if you add that increase in productivity, what does it look like? But I think that the bigger question that I would ask to what you're, or I think you're asking as well, is the solution isn't going to be to have more babies and grow them up real quick. The solution is going to have to be, what are we going to do differently to increase productivity? Because we can't do that. It's not going to be possible.
Mm-hmm.
So these are you're asking the right questions. Exactly.
Well, I just wanted to know somebody was actually thinking about that and giving me some comfort that you are. Thank you.
Yes.
Thanks, Mr.
Members, I think there is another meeting going on. We have a couple of people that want questions asked and answered. I'm going to have to room 546 because I have another meeting there. I'm going to ask that you give some concluding comments, and then members, if you'd like, please grab them and not hard, but approach them and ask them the questions, because we have another meeting. But I'll leave you to your closing comments, Mr. Wallstrom.
All I want to do is say thank you. I want to say thank you to the committee for your support. I especially want to call out Representative Winkler and Representative Burns for your support last year in helping to get us the money so we can do this. It's incredibly valuable. I also want to thank everybody that's in the room here, because there's a lot of people in the room who have put a lot of hours. You would be surprised at how many people in this state care enough to donate their time. And the time is what we need, because the people who are volunteering are people with tremendous experience and skills, and that's exactly what we need. So I want to say thank you to all of you.
I will close, Mr. Wallstrom, by thanking you for your energetic and tremendous leadership in trying to bring this together and bring our state into this particular industry in a greater way. No one has worked harder than you to do this, and I know it has come at a lot of energy and time on your part. So I as much as you appreciate our help, we really do appreciate the work that you do. Thank you. Members, with that, I advise you to talk to the members afterwards, the presenters afterwards. The meeting is now adjourned.